My name is Robert Owen. I'm assistant curator for the Redoubt Museum at present. We're standing here in the centre of the Redoubt, which is a large circular parade ground. At present it has the Eastbourne Model Village inside it. Basically, to describe the Redoubt, it looks very much, it's a circular structure, and it's split off into segmented barrack rooms called casemates. There are 24 of these casemates, each measuring 40 feet by 24 feet. On top of these is a gun platform with openings for 11 cannon when it was originally built. It was originally built in 1804, contemporary with the Martello Towers, to repel Napoleon's projected invasion of England between the years 1804 and 1812. The parade ground today is a different sight from what Napoleonic soldiers would have seen of it. They would have seen a circular area filled with beech material, which would sort of crunch underfoot, giving a very good marching sound. And they would have choked on the dust that would have come up in the sweltering heat as we have today. Today, however, we have a circular area some 200 feet across, filled with small buildings of the model village, and trees, flowers, quite a shady spot in this type of weather. In the background can be heard the bird song coming from the pine trees which have been planted in here to landscape the model village. It's rather unusual to see pine trees growing sort of against brickwork in a totally enclosed area, but the birds don't seem to mind it too much. And also going on in the parade ground area is restoration work on the building. The building was left to decay for several years following the war, and really only in the 1970s did Eastbourne Borough Council and the Department of the Environment decide that something had to be done, and restoration work commenced. At present, the workmen are restoring the large external staircase. In fact, there are two external staircases which go up to join at the top on the gun platform, and workmen are replacing the brickwork on this, which has deteriorated quite badly, and at the same time recapping the steps with the pink granite stone, which originally came from Jersey. Most of the stones are still there, but there are one or two which haven't been found yet, although it's hoped to recover them at a later date. We're now inside one of the casemates or barrack room areas of the Redoubt. As I say, there are some 24 of these. They're 40 feet long by 20 feet wide. They have a vaulted roof, and the windows are only at the parade ground side. There are two sash windows, one either side of the doorway, through which the sun at present is streaming, but even so, they're still pretty cold inside and a bit damp, not clammy or humid, quite refreshing in fact from the from outside really, which is a little bit too hot for my liking. But one can imagine that in the heat of the summer, that with some 24 people inside, that it would have got rather crowded and hot, and perhaps with a bit of cooking going on in here as well, it would have got rather greasy and sweaty, but obviously in those days home comforts weren't the prime concern of the soldiers. There would have been some 24 soldiers in each of these casemates. Not all were used for accommodation, some were used for storage purposes, and there can be still seen relics on the walls of the equipment racks which these soldiers would have each above their iron bed, which would project out into the centre of the casemate, giving a standard sort of barrack room appearance with rows of beds on either side, probably with kit folded ready for inspection on them, and then other kits stowed on these iron racks which protrude out from the wall rather dangerously at about 6 feet, 7 feet high. We're now walking through the Redoubt. Each casemate is interconnected. In the centre of it there is a passageway which runs around the Redoubt through the centre of each casemate. So it is possible to walk completely around the redoubt inside, starting at casemate number one, walking right the way around to casemate number four and back to number one again.
Would I be correct just in putting in here that this is the prison, the part?
Yes, that's right. We're standing now in the casemate, which has one end of it blocked off with a rather substantial door with a sort of trapdoor peephole arrangement in it and iron bars. It is in fact the guard room, or the guard detention room as it's known. And the idea being, of course, that as with most soldiers, there were the occasional defaulters who had to be reprimanded and taught a lesson, and this is where they would be kept for a suitable length of time until they'd learnt. But going out on a Friday night could be a pleasant occurrence, but they mustn't carry it too far. The original idea was to house a museum of coastal defences. The restoration work had started, and it was decided that the building should be put to some useful purpose, and a museum seemed an optimum suggestion. The original idea was to obtain material to illustrate the history of Britain's coastal defences. This was obtained several years ago from the Department of the Environment, and a small exhibition of photographic material was arranged, illustrating Britain's defence from the Roman period right through to the present day. In addition, there is the first phase of the Combined Services Museum. The Combined Services Trust is a trust which has been established to perpetuate the memory, as it were, of all services which served in Sussex in defence of the country and, in fact, abroad. So it serves two purposes. One, to show the defence nature of this part of England, being on the south coast and near any projected invasion. And it also serves as a memorial to the memory of those from the county who served so gallantly in the last two wars. At present, it isn't possible to walk completely around the redoubt because restoration work is still in progress. After the five restored casemates have been walked through, you then come across a bar and a large glass sheet which prevent you from going any further. But through the glass sheet, you can see the original condition of the casemates before anyone bothered to start work on them. And it does look a very sorry state indeed. The floors are filled with rubble, there's odd bits of timber lying around. The walls, which in the restored casemates are gleaming whitewash, in the unrestored section are peeling, the brickwork's flaking. In fact, it looks as if a bomb has hit the place. It's absolutely filled with lumps of concrete, old bricks, any old rubbish that can just have been thrown there because there was nowhere else to put it, basically. We've now walked back through the casemates, in fact, back to where we started, next door to the guard room. And this casemate here has been converted during the Napoleonic period into a cell block, presumably to contain sort of longer-term prisoners other than the overnight detainees which the guard room would have. There are three cells in here, and each is rather interesting because it's got some rather novel features. For example, when the inmate of one of the cells wished to communicate with his jailer, he would have a handle inside the cell which he would pull. This was connected by means of wires and pulleys and various cranks, rather in the system of the sort of domestic servant's bell system in an old house. And by pulling this lever, he would then ring a bell, which would summon the attention of the jailer to bring him water, food, or whatever was necessary. In addition, the captives weren't allowed any lights in their cells, possibly for fear of them setting light to the building if they were perhaps drunk or otherwise violent. And so each cell has a small window which would have originally had glass in it, and this had a light placed outside the cell, but the light was allowed to shine into the cell through this window. In order to economise on the number of lights required, the window for each cell is built at the end of the dividing wall. And so if a light was placed sort of at the end of the dividing wall, light could shine to the left and to the right into each cell either side of the dividing wall, thus meaning that only one light was required for every two cells.
That would be, what, a candle in those days?
It would be either a candle or a very sort of crude sort of hurricane lamp. More likely to be a candle, actually, I should think, yes.
And the back of this goes out into the moat.
That's right.
So you can't actually walk out into the moat.
No, you can't walk out into the moat. Well, it's not in fact a moat, it's a dry ditch. The difference being that a moat is full of water, and this is never intended to have water, it's just an obstacle. It's some 40 feet deep, I should think, and brick-lined on both sides, the one side being the outer wall of the redoubt itself, and the other side being a brick revetment wall. The idea of this being, of course, that it would keep any projective invasion out, and access to the redoubt, in fact, was from the gun platform across the moat by means of a drop bridge, which works on very much the same principle as a drawbridge, and instead of being drawn up, it drops down into the ditch itself.
Is there any advantages?
Yes, it's possible to shoot down a drawbridge. If you're a good enough shot, you can hit the ropes which support it, and then the bridge drops down and you charge. But with a drop bridge, it's already dropped. So even if you hit the ropes, it does no good, because you have to pull it up. So if you hit the ropes, it's impossible to pull it up. All that you do is, in fact, imprison the people inside, because they can't get it up either to get out. So that's the system.
I believe the army were part of the work party that came actually restoration on the actual bridge.
That's there. Right. In 1970-71, the Royal Engineers, who originally, in fact, built the bridge, well, the Royal Engineers did, not the people who restored it, of course, they came along from their barracks and restored the bridge themselves as a military exercise, and they found it extremely rewarding and rather challenging, and commented that it made quite a change from sort of the more traditional things that they're required to do, and it gave them a sense of purpose.
I'd assume then that the old plans were still to hand, so they knew exactly how the bridge was built originally.
That's true. The plans were available, and in fact the original bridge was still there. It was in a very, very bad condition and totally unsafe even to walk across. So they did have quite a good idea how the original was constructed, and hence how to reconstruct it. One interesting feature of the original bridge is that it's fairly substantial. It's made of, I think the material is oak, so you can gather that it's extremely heavy, and it required some 30 men to pull on the ropes to lift the bridge up once it had been dropped. So one imagines that, except in exceptional times and perhaps one exercise a year, that they didn't really bother with dropping the bridge, and just mounted a guard and two guard boxes which were mounted at the end of the bridge to deter any unwelcome guest. We're now climbing the stairs up to the gun platform. These stairs are set into the wall of the redoubt and go from that interior circular passageway and bend round. They're rather steep and rather like the average spiral staircase, only they're made of stone. And we're now coming into the blinding sunlight on the gun platform. This gun platform covers the complete top of the redoubt. In fact, if you look down on the redoubt, it's circular, with the Muddle Village in the centre on the parade ground, and then some perhaps 30 feet above the Muddle Village, on top of the casemates, is the gun platform where we're standing now. It's probably some 25, 30 feet wide, and today has a tarmac base to it, but originally it would probably be more likely to be cement. As we walk round, we can see the original positions for the guns. As I say, there are 11 of them, poking out through slits in the wall, and we can see the iron track on which the gun carriage would have traversed originally. There are two rails, one for the wheels at the front of the carriage and one for the wheels at the back. In the wall we can see the rings, iron rings, which would have been used to pass the ropes through from the gun carriage. These ropes had two functions. One was to take up a lot of the recoil when each cannon was fired. These cannons were 68 pounders, and so you can imagine that they did have a considerable recoil, bearing in mind that their range was some 2,000 yards. As well as taking the recoil, these ropes would also be used to actually physically move the carriage. Teams of men would pull on the rope in order to position the gun and aim it for the shot. The aiming of the cannon originally was very crude, in fact. A chap would stand at the back and just peer along from a little nick in the back of the cannon and peer along to a little protrusion on the muzzle and just line it up along those two sights and just hope that when it fired, it would just fire along that line. So it's very, very primitive sighting arrangement.
It's interesting that one assumes the fort would only fire its guns out at sea, but in actual fact, the guns are all the way round the whole of the top of here, so in actual fact, it was defended on all sides.
Yes, that's right. The meaning of the word redoubt really is a place which one retreats to if things really get bad. It's also a supply base and would have supplied the other Martello towers with both men, equipment, supplies, provisions and such like. But as you say, the gun positions are right round the top of this circular thing. They're pointing out to sea, they're pointing along the coast to the pier, they're pointing along the coast to Langley, and, in fact, back into the town. Obviously, in those days, the hotels and guest houses which are along Royal Parade weren't there, and this building was really on its own. So all that would have been seen by an enemy, in fact, is the very topmost portion of the redoubt wall, because the redoubt itself is really sunk below ground level. So only the cannon would be seen, and it'd be a very, very difficult target to attack.
What about signalling? How did they actually signal to the other Martello towers from here?
Yes, this is quite interesting. There are no remains on the redoubt, but the Martello towers did devise a rather ingenious method of signalling. It's not quite semaphore in the strict sense with flags, although that probably would have been originally used. In fact, they had a system of metal balls which were suspended from a mast. I suppose they rather look like pawnbroker balls. And these would be raised and lowered at various positions to convey various messages, such as the passage of ships, or whether, in fact, the commanding officer was making a snap inspection or something of that nature. And it probably was used to convey personal messages, prearranged signals between commanding officers on each of the towers.
We've just passed one of the original pulleys, haven't we?
That's right, yes. The ammunition would be stored in the casemates below this gun platform on which we're standing. And rather than cart it up the very narrow staircase up through which we came, there's a davit protruding over the edge of this gun platform and down into the parade ground area. And stores would have been originally slung on a hook there and just pulled up, again, by manpower. We've got to remember that everything in this period was done by manpower. There were no actual diesel winches or anything, of course. And all stores of any major nature would have been brought up via this davit here.
There would be just the one?
I think probably, yes. I think the casemate, in fact, which is directly below it, would have been the powder store. What is interesting, in fact, on the Martello Towers and on this redoubt, is that all the ammunition was stored on the seaward side. I say unusual because that would be where the invasion was coming, and one would think that any ship firing at the redoubt would hit it on the seaward side, so it was a rather stupid place to store the ammunition. But in fact, when they were building the towers, they built them much thicker on the seaward side, partly as a defence against the sea if they were very, very close to the sea, but also on the principle that it would strengthen them, and that this being the strongest part of the structure, it was also the safest place to put any explosive. So I think that that one there, which is virtually on the seaward side, would have been the ammunition store. Well, we're now actually standing on the drop bridge, which links the gun platform with the road, which would have sort of come up the bank from Royal Parade. As we stand on it and look down into the moat or the ditch, there's a rather odd building which should have links the floor on the floor of the moat, which should have links the two walls and effectively blocks the moat. This is called a caponier. The idea being that if the bridge was down and the redoubt was being stormed and they couldn't drop the bridge, although of course if there were invaders on the bridge they would have just dropped it then, and any invaders on it would have gone straight into the moat. But the idea of these caponiers was to give covering fire to the moat, so if anybody got ropes and climbed down into the moat and then tried to storm up the other wall of the redoubt, which would have been an extremely difficult task anyway, is made more difficult by these caponiers, because each caponier has five windows in it through which men would be firing a crossfire with muskets and rifles at anybody actually inside the moat. So even if you got in the moat, that was only the beginning of your troubles, and you certainly would be unlikely to get out alive, in fact, because to climb up a 40-foot wall on a rope when people are taking pot shots at you, I think would be extremely difficult.
Coming out of the roof of those is two metal encasements. I would assume they were some sort of gun position.
That's right. I think they're probably a little later than the original. The roof itself, is, if you notice, is unusual in that it is brick. But these two sort of trapdoors in the roof, as I say, I think they're later. But again, they would be, in fact, so that people could stand inside, open the trapdoor, and then fire directly up at people on this bridge where we're standing now. Of course, today, one would think it'd be very, very easy to silence a position like that by throwing a grenade straight in. But of course, in those days, grenades were very new and very unpredictable and very unreliable. So they didn't really have to bother about that. They could have stood there in relative safety and picked off the people on the bridge quite easily, I think.
The pipe running across the top, is that a recent addition?
No, it isn't. In fact, it's probably Victorian, but it does come from the latrines, which are positioned just to the right of the bridge. And in effect, it's a very primitive sewage system linking it with the town's Victorian sewers. The water supply to the redoubt, in fact, is very complicated and very unusual, in that there are a couple of wells inside the redoubt, but a lot of the water was collected straight from the roof and was fed down through the brickwork, actually inside the walls, which were built rather like cavity walls. It was led down through the brickwork in lead channels, and then from there down to a big cistern which was underneath the centre of the parade ground. Unfortunately, the lead from these conduits has now disappeared. Obviously, somebody had the bright idea that they could sell the lead for a great profit, which has caused quite considerable problems to the architects in restoring the building, in that many of these channels haven't been adequately mapped, and consequently water from the roof filters down into the brickwork, and the brickwork is so porous that the whole building is extremely damp, even on a day like today. And I think you'll notice that when we were in there, it was a bit chilly and a little damp. So that's basically the reason. It's this rather weird plumbing system that they had. Lying on the top here, just on one of these metal rails which the gun carriages traverse on, is in fact a piece of gun carriage. It's not actually from the redoubt, but it still has an interesting history. The Martello Towers, of course, used to stretch the whole length of the south and, in fact, the east coast, and there were 73 towers, or 74 at a later date, in fact, towers along this southern coast alone. So they were pretty closely spaced. Of course, there is the Wish Tower, Tower 73, which is now preserved. And then along the coast, there would have been another one at approximately the position where the pier is now. Then would come the redoubt, and then several more towers extending right round along the coast. We can Today you can see the one at Langley. It's a very clear day, so that one is still standing. But in between that one at Langley and the one
Pevensey Bay.
Pevensey Bay area and the redoubt here, there would have been quite a number more. These towers disappeared over the, well, really over the last century. Many of them were washed into the sea, and some of them were used as targets for the army to try out new forms of artillery. There used to be a tower down by the fishing station, and during the extremely high tides and storms that we had last year, it was brought to my attention that the shingle had been moved, and a large piece of timber with an iron wheel was sticking out. It appeared, in fact, that this had been used to moor boats up, the length of chambers attached to it, and had been used to anchor boats to. But the shingle had been cleared, revealing that, in fact, what somebody thought was an old railway sleeper was, in fact, this section of gun carriage. The timber itself is probably, what, about 16 inches square in section, and extremely solid and heavy. One man couldn't possibly lift it, even though it only measures some probably 3 feet by 2 feet. Attached to the end of it is a rather rusty metal wheel, some 16 inches in diameter. And this would have been one of the wheels, of which there would have been four, that would have actually run along rails similar to these, set on the top of each tower. We do believe that this is part of the gun carriage from, I think it's Tower 66, which would have been down by the fishing station. Well, we're now sort of sitting on what might be called the battlements, for want of a better term, overlooking the sea, and all the holidaymakers sort of walking along the front enjoying themselves. But we can think of those times back in 1804 when a soldier might have been here taking a quick rest from drill or cleaning out the cannon, and the sight that he would see would be totally different. Be no holiday makers then. In fact, he'd look out, probably looking at the sea in case Napoleon's fleet should appear on the horizon, or looking along the coast, he'd see the reassuring sight of some 6 or 8 Martello towers spaced at about 300-yard intervals, and he'd probably take comfort in the fact that, as far as he was concerned, no one would ever get past those towers, and if they did, at least Eastbourne's redoubt would stop Napoleon's forces. But today the whole scene's changed. Gone are the shouts of the sergeant majors, replaced by the laughter of holidaymakers and the click of camera shutters. Totally different scene. But I think that we must remember that if this building hadn't been built, admittedly it was never used, but the mere fact that it was built may have deterred Napoleon. And so today I think that Eastbourne should take note of the fact that back in 1804 it would have certainly have stirred a great emotion in the hearts of the nation to think that Eastbourne was defending the country.